Welcome to Inside Voices, a World Read Magazine Between the Pages podcast. Thank you for joining us. I'm your host, Robert Gwaltney.
And I'm host Jeffrey Dale Lofton. And we are just beside ourselves with joy to have with us Leslie Zemeckis. But before we begin today, we want to share a little bit about you, Leslie, with our listeners. So, Leslie, you're the best-selling author, actor, and award-winning documentarian of Behind the Burlicue, which ran on Showtime, Bound by Flesh, which debuted at number 5 on Netflix, and the multi-award-winning Mabel Tiger Trainer. And next up, I understand, is the award-winning documentary Grand Horizontals about courtesans in Napoleon's Second Empire. But you're also the author of 3 bestsellers, Behind the Burlicue, which is the definitive history, oral history of burlesque, and an Amazon top 100 pick, Goddess of Love Incarnate, The Life of Striptease Lily Sancerre, and Feuding Fan Dancers, about Sally Rand, Faith Bacon, and the Golden Age of the Showgirl, which is a Southern California Independent Booksellers Association finalist for biography.
Leslie's also acted alongside Tom Hanks, Steve Carell, Jim Carrey, Mickey Rourke, and Richard Lawson. She's the founder of Stories Matter, female storytellers mentoring future female storytellers in conjunction with the Santa Barbara International Film Festival and Entity Magazine. Honored for her work inspiring women, Zemeckis was awarded the Ellis Island Medal of Honor in 2023 for sharing and preserving stories of women who were once marginalized and stigmatized. The medal is officially recognized by both houses of Congress as one of the nation's most prestigious awards. Welcome, Leslie.
Thank you.
So, Leslie, you're an actor, you're a documentarian, you're an author. That's an impressive range by anybody's reckoning. Is there one of these that you hold dearest, or do you love all your children the same, equally?
Yeah, all the same. I mean, they're all, to me, it's all storytelling from different points of view, either, you know, as an actor or telling it in a book or by film, and certain subject matters, at least the ones, not the acting, but for me, when I find something I like, it's either a book or it's a film. It'll be pretty obvious to me which what it is. So I like them all.
So you love all your children equally.
Yeah, and I like switching back. I don't like to do book or film. I actually like switching back and forth or doing them at the same time. It just helps me creatively.
You know, usually books typically precede anything that is film, you know, a documentary or a film. But I understand that Burlicue was originally a documentary and then it was a book. Can you tell us why you made that decision?
Because, well, it was when I first decided I wanted to do a documentary on the history of burlesque. And I went out shooting for 2 years all across the country, finding anybody I could that was still alive that had been in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, 50s. I gathered so many stories that only so much can go into. I think my film's 80 something minutes, that I wanted to expand upon it in a book and tell more of the stories. So that's why I was like, you know, these stories have to live. So then I did the book afterwards.
Behind the Burlicue, Goddess of Love, and Feuding Fan Dancers, all of these books focus on or center around burlesque. What drew you to, or how did you find your way to the world of burlesque?
I don't know. I can't get out. It was just complete happenstance. I was doing a one-woman show, and it was a very sassy character that I'd created that I kind of thought Gypsy Rose Lee without even knowing what I was saying. You know, so I would do research. What was Gypsy and what was burlesque? And then the more I did research for that, I realized there was so little on the history of it from the women's point of view. They would talk about a woman's act, like Lily Sincere. She was in a bathtub and they would mention some headlines about her life and nothing else. And I thought, well, who really were these people? I hate just labels of stripper. You know, where did they come from? What did their family think? And so I just, you know, on my own started researching it, got hooked up with some few older performers, obviously, that were no longer performing. I just one day was like, I have to tell these stories. I'm going to go do a documentary. And then once I started talking to a couple of them, which was hard to penetrate at first, because there's such a stigma, such misunderstanding about the subject and what they did in it. They didn't really talk about it a lot. Some women hadn't talked about it for 50 years. One woman I interviewed, she was 70s. She had never told her adult children that were 40 in their 40s until the year before. So they were what was interesting to me, and the way they made their living, and that it was so huge in America that today we've forgotten what it was. As much as they could be considered outsiders and stigmatized, it was a premier form of entertainment for couples, for anybody. And they really made a great living. And through that, I just kind of got fascinated by other stories. I mean, but I thought that, you know, this is it. I'll do the film, do the book. When it came out, Lily Sincere's sister, who also was a huge stripper in her time, she was married to Harold Minsky, which Minsky, everybody knows at least that name if they know nothing else about burlesque. She came to me and said, you have to do a story. You have to do Lily's story. And I was like, no, thank you. I'm done. I've, you know, covered it. She gave me a box of information. And then, of course, because I got curious, I started researching it. Her life was amazing, completely untold. So that's why I did her story. Feuding fan dancers, I was always fascinated by Faith Bacon, who I cover a little bit in my film. I couldn't find out a lot about her. I covered Sally Rand in the film. But Faith was a super tragic story, and it bothered me, and I wanted to know why she ended the way she ended when she was a huge, she was more, her and Sally were more considered showgirls. They were in vaudeville. And I just was, you know, it's these things, everything I do, it's like, I have to tell this story. They just happened to kind of be in this world of burlesque or vaudeville or early forms of American pop culture.
What about, you know, you mentioned the stigma.
Mm-hmm.
What about the power? I mean, during that era, there were fewer opportunities for women, but there seems to be a measure of power. These women wielded a measure of power and, you know, made a lot of money while they were, you know, working. What about the power dynamic?
Well, it kind of depends on the era. I think more towards the 50s, they did feel that. And I'm speaking in general terms. You know, I interviewed, you know, I've got hundreds of hours of tape. In general, it was a way for these women, a lot uneducated, a lot from abusive backgrounds, to do something with their life. It was something that they could do to get out of that. They were supporting families, supporting children. They wanted to be a star of some sort, a lot of them. A lot of them had dance training. So it was a means of really doing something with their lives and loving what they did for the most part, most of them. I don't think they felt so much empowered in the 20s and 30s and the 40s, somewhat, but it's not as if you talk to girls that are in burlesque today who are there's no, when burlesque during the golden age, you could work every night of the week all year long. There's not that industry now. Obviously there's film and TV and everything else. So it's more of a choice now, where by then it was a way of making a living a lot of times.
You know, I'm interested in the approach that you took with researching the books. You mentioned that there was one individual whose adult children didn't even know that she once had a career in burlesque. How challenging was it for you to get these women to open up?
You know, not bad at all. They actually were dying to tell their stories. So many of them, I cannot tell you, said, nobody ever asked me. And I think they were just at a time in their lives. The stigma had passed. Our society is much more different, considering if you just, you know, do the label stripper. So they really wanted to tell their stories. They were very inviting. They invited me into their homes. They invited me into all their scrapbooks. They really, really opened up. I mean, I found that I love interviewing. I think I do all the research myself. So I think some of them were very surprised at my knowledge coming in there, that I could talk about this person or that person. And I know a couple interviews, like Alan Alda, for one, his father was a straight man and a singer in burlesque. You know, I talked to Alan and I said, will you do the interview? Yes, I've got a half hour, just got a half hour, you know, which I heard a couple times. And then they end up, you know, being very engaged and would be there much longer for the interview.
Was there any, did you go into your research with any preconceived notions about the world of burlesque that were dispelled when you were complete with your project?
No, because I really knew nothing. I mean, I, of course, before I was doing interviewing, I did as much research and reading, and it was just interesting to me. It's another form of entertainment, and there was just so many unanswered questions. So I just wanted the answers, you know. What did your parents think? How did you get your name? What was life like on the road? To me, it was just interesting things. And I just ask stuff that is interesting, what I want to know. And I figure if I want to know it, the audience is going to want to know it.
What about your research process? Was it primarily interviews of people who were still around? What
Yes. I mean, I did a lot of reading of newspapers, tons of books, magazines, you know, any kind of archives, which there are. I think I went to New York. I went to various places. And then trying to just keep all the threads in my head. So when I talk to, and some things were just coincidence, but this is why I do my own research. I was talking to, for instance, the woman who said she'd never told anyone until her adult children. She happened to mention a very famous burlesque woman. And she said, oh, I was there when she gave her child away. You know, this woman had done gazillions of interviews because she was one of the only ones well known, and it never came up. So I waited. I interviewed her probably for a couple hours. And towards the very end, because I wasn't sure how she was going to react, I asked her about that. And it was just like this moment of like, she's like, how do you know about that? And then she told me the complete whole story, but it was just, you know, picking up and really keeping all those threads that people would talk about because they were kind of connected or they knew something about somebody and they had heard a rumor, you should talk to this person because of this. So it's just keeping that knowledge and just digging, digging, digging. It's not like your first Google, you know, it's getting first sources and really honoring what their life was, good or bad. So I don't go in with like, oh, I really like this person and I'm going to show them as this. It's like, no, let's discover who they are and what they thought about things.
You referenced the stigma that went along hand in hand with burlesque in the sense that there were strippers. But, you know, there are those that really regard burlesque as an art form. How did the women that you interviewed, how did they think about the work that they did? How did they regard themselves?
I think most of them absolutely regarded themselves as artists. There was maybe aspects they didn't like that maybe were tough. Some theaters were worse than others. But what was really interesting to me that I discovered is when you're not like a chorus girl or in, you know, part of another act or the company that's there, but if you're the stripper that's headlining or traveling from place to place, you're your own producer and director. You go in and you say, here's my music. This is what I'm dancing to. And it's not like you're trying to fit into a show and it's like, this is what I'm wearing. I mean, you get to do what you want. And some of these women were super creative and they had so much fun with it. I remember talking to Blaze Starr, one of the bigger stars in the 50s. She was telling me, you know, she's got this beautiful little Southern accent. She's talking about how she took some peach cans and she opened them up and she put a fire in there. And then she lit her little couch on fire on stage. I mean, they loved doing whatever they wanted, which was just sometimes crazy. Like she came in with animals all the time. She'd have a panther or a cheetah or this or that. And that's just what they got to do. So they really loved the artistry of it. They loved their costumes. If they didn't have them made, they spent hours sewing and making them themselves.
Did any of the ladies that you spent time with, did they share any of their famous burlesque moves with you?
No. Some of them, there's a lot of footage out there. but I didn't want to seem exploitive in that fashion. I just wanted this story, and I wanted to be careful about how I filmed them, that it was just kind of straightforward, them talking, because you can make your subject, you could distract the audience by showing all the, like one person had gold rings over there, and you could get distracted by this, oh, interesting, quirky, flashy character and not hear her story. So I didn't want them to get up and repeat what they had done 40 years before. They maybe talked about it, and they showed me their costumes and all their pictures, and they were super proud of it, but I didn't want them to recreate.
Yeah.
You know, so as a documentarian, and that's interesting because, you know, that's not my world. When you go into, of course, that was the research for your books, and of course, Burley Q, being both a book and a documentary, what are there strict rules of the art of documentary that you follow? Talk a little bit about the guidelines and those things that you think are most important from your point of view as an artist.
Well, to me, you have to be completely ethical with your subject matter, whoever you're interviewing, and super respectful. For instance, my third film is about Mabel Stark, who was, quote unquote, the world's first female tiger trainer. Now, when I start, this is my third film. Everything's been very lauded. And I started calling people who, female former tiger trainers, to talk to them. And it was, oh, we don't want to talk to you. And it was, why? The PETA's come in here and they fooled us. They act like they are gonna portray us as our story is. And I was just, it never occurred to me. I was like, you know, I'm not there to try and get anybody. I'm just gonna ask you questions, and I don't have a point of view whether it's good or bad what you did. So it's really, you really have to gain their trust that you're going in there to ask them. And what I said is, like, I want to know what it's like as a female in this industry and what you know about Mabel Stark. I mean, you can't have a secret agenda of what you're really trying to do is get this story about how she fed her cats. It's like, you really have to be upfront and honest about everything. So the next film that people, because people do check you out. And I had one man who was Mabel Stark's last protege. And because of my prior films, he's like, I have her trunks. I have her scrapbooks. It's all yours. Just by keeping that, you know, respect for who you're talking to and honesty and knowledge and knowing what you're doing. So that to me is like the only rule that I know about or would follow. And I'm not sure everybody does that. But
no, right. And I don't think so. You know, you can definitely see some documentarians who have a slant, you know, and have an agenda when they go into their storytelling. I have to say that Bound by Flesh was so compelling, and I thought that you handled it beautifully. The story of the Hilton sisters, oh my goodness, what human drama. Would you like to talk a little bit about Bound by Flesh?
Yeah, I mean, I only discovered them because there were Siamese twins. I only discovered them because briefly they went into burlesque, which I thought was horrifying. You know, they're conjoined twins. They were given away at birth. I read this fascinating book and I interviewed the man. And then I kept thinking about, do I want to do this as my next documentary? Do I? And then when I read that I shared the same birthday with them, I was like, okay, I'm doing it. And to me, they were a label. They were freaks. They were Siamese twins. And that's all people knew about them when you read or you Googled them or you saw them. And I wanted to discover who they really were. Their life was amazing, super interesting, a lot of sadness, a lot of funny things. But I wanted to show that they were people, ultimately.
Yeah, very naive and very sheltered, these two. And what's interesting is that they really sort of understood or wanted to stray from the stigma of being freaks. They Absolutely. Didn't necessarily consider themselves part of that world.
And that to me was what is so tragic about the story. Now there's, you know, the sideshow that's been on Broadway, and they've had a couple of revivals, and which I love the music. The only thing they get wrong is they portray the twins as considering themselves freaks, and the rest of the world thinks they're normal. Where the tragedy was, they consider themselves completely normal. Why wouldn't somebody want to marry us? Why wouldn't this? Where the world was looking at them as nothing but freaks. And they could never understand. That's why they were taken advantage of and, you know, dumped here and there, because they just didn't have a concept that they were that different.
Yeah. And Leslie, you've talked about, you know, the art form of burlesque and the, you know, the spectacle of all of these lives that you've documented, Mabel and sisters and the burlesque queens. But, and I guess you mentioned that it's gotten easier for you to gain access to people, not just only them, but people who knew them, because you have, you know, they can do research on you and they know that they know your motivation. They know that you really want to tell their story. Can you tell us about how you've really explored that really personal side of them rather than the spectacle? How do you, as a documentarian, focus in and really tell the personal story amidst all this show?
Well, what I try to do, and I've been lucky enough that there's been enough source material, is to mostly tell the story from their point of view. I mean, you know, the burlesque people, obviously they talked to me, so they told me their point of view. There was enough stuff on the twins that I could tell it through what it was like for them. It's like, I want to have as much material or find as much material, if it's a letter or what they told me this or that, so that they're as much as possible, even though they're long gone, telling their story. And the audience can take away from it whatever they want, and they can feel however they want. I mean, of course, by the end of it, I want them all to fall in love with these people, but it's for the audience to decide. And sometimes there's conflicting stories. She did that. No, she didn't do that.
And how do you deal with it?
I leave it. You know, sometimes there's something inbound by flesh where this man was a former manager and he's talking about, oh, and they went on the road with so-and-so managed them. Cut to somebody else saying, oh, their last manager dumped them. Well, it's for you to decide who you think that is. But I think the way I cut it, you get an idea of who it is.
You know, your work with telling the stories of women who've been stigmatized or marginalized was recognized, as we discussed in your biography. And you are the 2023 recipient of the Ellis Island Medal of Honor. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, it was surprising. It actually was a proposed right before COVID, I think. And then, so it's been delayed many years. But it was really surprising and moving to be at Ellis Island. And to think, you know, some of these women, well, I know the twins, the Siamese twins came through Ellis Island, but to have part of their history resonate, you know, and live on, which is what I try and do in my stories and my films. So, you know, that's kind of a nice circle, you know.
Congratulations. It's a huge accomplishment.
And Leslie, you're, you know, as a fellow author, I probably speak for Robert as well. I admire that you support other authors. You appreciate their work. You uplift them. You highlight them. Talk about your role as yet another role you have as a book influencer. How it began, and you know, all of that.
Well, you know, it's like partly the pandemic. It gave this, you know, everybody's Zooming and posting and reading. I think books did well. And I just thought, well, you know what? I'm going to do it. I'm going to show you what I like. I'm going to call authors and or however I can get to them and say, hey, do you want me to go on and I'll post you and we'll talk about it? Or about that time, I think I had started my mentoring group, Stories Matter, and it had to be on Zoom with girls. So it was all kind of like, let's just talk about stories. I love books. I love authors. I love that I connected with Robert over his magnificent book. Good God. I mean, why wouldn't you want to tell the world about it? And I think out of almost all the arts, the book community is super, I think, supportive. And open, right. And it's like, and they love to talk about process or problems or the great things. I was just talking to an author today about book signings and how nobody tells you can go to your first book signing and there's four people there, you know, and it's like everybody's been through it. So I just like that connection. I love telling what books I love. I write a book column here in Montecito for the Montecito Journal, recommending books every month. And it's just, you know, sharing what I love.
That's great. Do you want to highlight a book right now?
I did just finish a book called Rouge by Mona. I have it someplace. I can't remember that. I don't know. It's coming out in September. It's so dark and funny and strange about the beauty world. I loved it. And Sarah DeVellos has a new book out, which is the era I love, the 20s, about a jazz baby that was murdered. It's a true story, brought up. Butterfly Broadway. It's great. So I like to go between, you know, like I read a lot of fiction and then nonfiction.
So Leslie, we've had an opportunity to talk about your work as a documentarian, as an author, but we've not had an opportunity for you to touch on your work as an actress. Anything in that regard that you'd like to share? The strike, I know.
Well, I think it's going to last a while, but I shot a film last year called Here with Tom Hanks and Robin Wright, and an amazing cast that's coming out 2024. And I shot a film with Mickey Wark that'll probably come out about then. It's just, you know, because of the strike, I think stuff's getting pushed too. But yeah, I can't wait to get back to it. I love acting.
Well, Leslie, thank you so much for joining Jeffrey and me today. It has been a pleasure.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I love what you guys are doing.
Thank you. And gentle listeners, I hope you've enjoyed spending time with us today. Until next time, I'm Robert Gwaltney for Inside Voices for Well Read Magazine.
And I'm Jeffrey Dale Often. And remember, to be creative is to be courageous. Thanks for joining us.
True.